From the highest mountains to the bluest seas, the driest deserts to the icy poles, Kate Turkington has traveled there, and now she's inviting you to travel with her through your radio. Travels with Kate, Sundays at 12 midday, only on 101.9 High FM.
And a very good afternoon to you all. It's Sunday, it's 12 noon, beautiful, beautiful Johannesburg, sunny day, and it's Travels with Kate on High 101.9. And lovely interview I hope to be doing a bit later on in the program with David O'Sullivan, who co-authored the book Ressi, published by Pam Macmillan with Ressi himself. It's been number one on the nonfiction bestseller list in South Africa for ages. So we're hoping to get some real truths out of that about Ressi. And also what I'm going to do, low ball, I'm going to ask David who he thinks is going to win the World Cup. David O'Sullivan, of course, being a sports presenter, a sports broadcaster, a sports writer for years and years and years, one of our most well-loved and most familiar voices you're going to hear. So that's going to come up a bit later in the program. And I had lots of feedback from you on social media about Cuba. We talked about Cuba last week, and I must say, many of you have got quite excited about going to Cuba. And what I always say to you, go now. Travel now. Don't wait till you're old, or don't wait till the children are grown up. Or do it now. You never know. Never know what the future holds. Do it while you can, and then eat bread and water for the rest of the year or whatever. Okay, I'm going to tell you about Mallorca. Mallorca, that Spanish island in the Balearic Isles. Of course, Rafa Nadal came from there, so it's got very famous since. But in the 60s, all the Brits, I was still living in the UK then, all the Brits used to call it Mallorca. We're going to Mallorca this year. Yeah, that's where we're having our summer holiday. And Mallorca became synonymous with very low-end package tours and ham and chips and beer and basically yobbos on the beaches. But it's really shrugged off that image today. It's sloughed off that image of just sea, sun, and sweaty northern European bodies desperate for a tan. And it has reinvented itself as Mallorca. That double L, it's spelled M-A-double-L-O-R-C-A, but it's the soft Spanish sound, Mallorca, Mallorca. So it's going back to its roots. Still in season, one of the busiest airports in the world at Palma. Hundreds of airplanes land each day at Palma, and it makes it the eighth busiest airport in Europe. Think about that. Europe's a big place with hundreds of airports, and this very small island, Mallorca, has the eighth busiest airport in the world. And season is pretty much all year round. Obviously, the European summer months are the busiest, but otherwise, it's very, very busy. And it's got incredible history, apart from the beaches and whatever. It's got a history of Bronze Age, Roman. The Romans were there. The Vandals were there. The Byzantines were there. The Moors were there. And there was enough pirate activity to make Captain Jack Sparrow actually lick his luscious lips. So today, it's much, much more than sunshine, egg and chips, sauerkraut, and cheap beer. And I'll be telling you some of the things you can do and some of the things you can see after the break.
From the highest mountains to the bluest seas, the driest deserts to the icy poles, Kate Turkington has traveled there, and now she's inviting you to travel with her through your radio. Travels with Kate, Sundays at 12 midday, only on 101.9 High FM.
So we're going to Mallorca today. And really, since the 1950s even, not just the 60s, the 50s, tourist figures have risen. They get over 11 million visitors a year, which isn't bad for an island that's only a seventh the size of Sicily. Think of that. You know, Sicily, the bottom of the boot of Italy, Sicily's not a very big island. Mallorca's only a seventh of that size. The first thing you must do when you get to Malta is to buy a whistle. You may think that's very strange. It's called a sorrel. It's a traditional handheld clay whistle of the island. The people love a whistle, beloved by that very famous Spanish artist who, he wasn't a Mallorcan, but he lived in Mallorca, Joan Miró. And the whistle had a very strong influence on his work. So buy yourself a whistle and then bring it home. And then I love Roman cities. I love Roman remains. I'm fascinated by the history of Rome. In the northeast of the island was the Roman capital, Palencia. Palencia. And think about it. What better posting was there for war-weary veterans and legionnaires and colonists than to be posted to somewhere like Polenta? Think of being posted to Britain, damp, miserable, cold, not incredibly friendly people at the time. But Polenta was just the most wonderful place to be posted to. And you go there today, you can stroll through the forum, you can stroll through the streets, the villas, and you get a sense of the former grandeur of the place. And of course, mostly where the Romans put a capital or they put a town of any mark whatsoever, they built a theatre. And in Palencia, there's a 2,000-seater open-air theatre, and it looks out to sea. So as so often with Roman theatres and amphitheatres, they built them with the surrounding scenery as part of the architecture. So you sit in this huge amphitheatre, the play would be performed in front of you on the sandy arena, and then you've got the blue Mediterranean waving there in the background. Semicircular auditorium, the front was open to the sea. Think gladiator. But there was even an orchestra pit and a rectangular stage in the auditorium. And what was most important was what you wore to the theatre, doll. Romans love to dress up. And Palencia was very, very important because many weavers and tailors settled here. And actually, Palencia, on this little island of Mallorca, became the fashion centre of the Roman world. Would you believe it? I mean, think Paris, think Rome. Anyone who was anybody had to have a toga or a cloak made in Palencia. Think the ancient equivalent of a Gucci label or a Yves Saint Laurent label or whatever. And even Julius Caesar, the emperor himself, had a latex clava. That's probably not pronounced properly. That's the Latin word for a robe. Latex clava. His best robe came from Palencia. Okay, when you've done the Roman stuff, you can go physical. All sorts of water sports available all over the island. You can go hiking, gorgeous, gorgeous mountain trails, and cycling. Mallorca's become one of the cycling centres of the world. 200,000 cyclists a year go to Mallorca. By the way, most times the best time, but January to May, probably the best month. It's a top cycling destination now, with very safe and challenging mountain roads. Lots of hotels really cater for cyclists. They have cycling facilities from sports massage therapists to equipment shops to rentals. So if you're a cyclist and you're looking for another country to go to, not too dreadfully expensive, think Mallorca. They really cater for cyclists from amateurs to professionals. And then if you want a bit more culture, and if you're very brave and you're vertigo free, then you can rent a car and drive from Palencia to Valdemossa. And why would you go to Valdemossa? Because that's where Chopin lived with his mistress, Georges Sand, who of course was a woman, but she wrote under the name of Georges Sand. And that's where they took themselves away from Paris gossip. It's absolutely lovely. If you survive the 57 kilometers of the island's most notorious hairpin bends, you end up at the Chopin Museum, the house he lived in. By the way, we didn't survive. We rented a car, and our driver, you can't see what's coming around the hairpin bends, and he was a very good driver, but he came round a hairpin bend, and a bus actually took the side off the car. Nobody was hurt, but cost a lot of money, I must say. We got saved by two Albanian immigrants, tow truck immigrants, who actually towed us back to the house somebody had lent us. So Chopin, beautiful little museum there, gorgeous scenery, mountains, deep pine forests, farmhouses, fairy tale churches, and almost everywhere, gorgeous views of the sea. If you're faint-hearted, go by bus. It's easy, reasonably cheap, and your stress levels will be far, far lower, unless, warning, don't sit in the front of the bus if you're nervy at all. And then the capital of the island itself is, of course, Palma. Don't even think about having a meal in Palma unless you go into the back street somewhere, because all the zillionaires and oligarchs' yachts are parked at Palma, and it's very, very expensive. But you must go there for the cathedral, because it's got one of the most beautiful and spectacular cathedrals in Europe, Palma de Mallorca, the Palma Cathedral. Fantastic cathedral. It really is a must-see visit for you. The building began in 1229. Just think of that, 1229. And then over the centuries, it's undergone various additions and renovations and expansions. And so you'll see that in the cathedral architecture itself, because you've got architectural styles, Gothic, Renaissance, Baroque. It really is an architectural masterpiece. And who had a hand in the building of it? None other than Gaudi. Anybody who's been to Sagrada Familia in Barcelona and seen that cathedral would walk into the Palma Cathedral and recognize Gaudi's influence there. It's a beautiful chandelier in the middle of the nave with a crown of thorns as the kind of main theme of it. And when you go to the cathedral, climb the spiral staircase and go up to the bell tower, because you get the most wonderful views. You get a 360 panoramic view of Palma, the sea, the mountains. It really is worth the effort. And there's also a very, very good modern art museum with some of the best of Spanish art. Think Joan Miró, think Picasso, think local artists as well. And then lastly, there's a round castle. Have you ever heard of a round castle? I'd never seen a round castle before. It's a 14th century castle called Belver Castle. Belver Castle. A circular design. It's got a very commanding hilltop location. It stands on a wooded hill overlooking the city and the sea. It's one of the very, very few circular castles in Europe, built during the 14th century. And again, an absolute masterpiece of Gothic architecture. And be sure, there's a circular walkway going right round the castle walls, so you can just amble along this walkway. And again, you get the most stunning views of the whole of Parma and of the countryside beyond. And then, of course, the shopping, leather, oh, souvenirs, embroidery, bags, all kinds of boutiques. So it's an island cut off from the world in some ways, but has become so well known now to holidaymakers, really well worth a visit. And remember, it's the home, he still lives there when he's not living in America or elsewhere, of Rafa Nadal. I don't think there's a museum for Rafa Nadal yet, I'm not sure, but if there isn't, there surely will be. So there you are, Mallorca.
From the highest mountains to the bluest seas, the driest deserts to the icy poles, Kate Turkington has traveled there, and now she's inviting you to travel with her through your radio. Travels with Kate, Sundays at 12 midday, only on 101.9 High FM.
And a very good afternoon to you once again. Your voice you're now going to hear, you'll recognize immediately. It's one of our favorite broadcasters. He's been around quite a long time, nowhere near as long as me, but he's our number one sportscaster. He's been on Capital Radio 702, Hot 91.9, Power Car, you name it. David O'Sullivan, who I may tell you started life as a lawyer. David, how did you get out of that?
I chose to go for fun rather than money, Kate, I think is the answer, because I'd done 8 years at Capital Radio. Then I decided I needed to learn something else. And so at the age of 30, I went and studied law. And then I was practicing law at Weber Wenzel. I was doing my articles. And as I came to the end of my articles, I realized there was still such an enormously long slog still to go. But there was so much fun still to be had in journalism. And then an offer came to go and work at 702. And I jumped at that. I was unmarried. I didn't have kids. I didn't have any dependents. I could choose. I funded myself. So I said, you know what? That's what I want to do. I know my parents were probably horrified, but they also had no say in the matter. And so I went for fun. That's how I got out of it.
Now, why am I talking to David today? Well, if you've been near any bookshop, turned on any radio station, looked in any newspaper, you would have seen that his book, Rassi, written with Rassi Erasmus, is number one on the best-selling list in South Africa. So, published by Pam Macmillan, as I say, I when I got my copy, I offered it first to my son, then to two of my sons-in-law, then a close friend. They'd already bought one. You'll be pleased to. You'll be
very
pleased
good
to hear, David. So, how come David O'Sullivan is writing a book about Rassi Erasmus? And when, David, they first approached you to write this book, I mean, what were your reactions?
Well, it came about out of the blue. I got a call from Pam Macmillan just before Christmas. I had been in conversation with them, with Mandy Wiener, who writes all her books through Pam Macmillan, and she had been cajoling me to write a book of some sort. And the initial thought it would be the story of my career in journalism and all the hijinks and dramas and fun. I mean, as I said, it's been an amazingly fun career. But I didn't think that anybody would really want to hear that. I also felt that the story hadn't been told, because inextricably tied up in my life story is that of my son Michael, who's autistic. And I felt that Michael's still got a lot to go through. And I want to, if I'm going to write something, it's going to have to include my son's journey as well. And so I wasn't that keen. But Pam Macmillan was still interested in me writing something for them. And they had been in talks with Rassi Erasmus for a while, for about a year. Rassi himself, as I give his side of the story, He felt that he wasn't in the market for a book simply because he's not a book person. He didn't see the value attached to a book. As he said to me when he met me, he had only ever read one book in his life, and that was at school. It was Lord of the Flies.
Oh, well.
And I said to him, well, you're going to have to read two books because you're going to have to read your own book. And he also felt I was going to judge him because he'd never read a book. I said I didn't think that that would happen because he is clearly so incredibly knowledgeable that without reading a book, he's one of those rare people who's like a sponge when he learns through other means, from people talking to him, through life experiences, and he can then get his wisdoms from that. So I was very happy to deal with somebody like Rassie. The other thing was that in a previous life, I'd also worked for SABC Television, SABC Sport. I presented a rugby show every Wednesday evening, which Rassie had watched. I'd written for SA Rugby magazine. I'd covered a lot of rugby in my career as when I was concentrating on sport. I fluctuate news and sport. I don't see them as they're both forms of news. And anyway, so Rassie knew about me. I certainly knew about him, having covered his entire career. And Pam McMillan put us together. The thing was, though, would we work together? Would we be a good match? And we had to have an initial meeting. And to answer the second part of your question, what did I feel about this, was I was excited because Rassie was this controversial person. He was, to some extent, divisive. He did things that upset legions of people and delighted equal numbers of supporters. And I found him an intriguing person. So I was quite keen to get to know him and write this story.
And you say, you actually say in the book that you thought you knew him because of all your rugby background, because of having read so much about him. But in fact, you didn't know him at all, did you?
I didn't know him at all. And when we sat down, we met at the Crendel Wine Farm in Durbanville at the beginning, the end of January. And he said, I said, what do you want to get out of this book? And he said, I want the accurate picture painted of who I am, because everybody gets me wrong. And so the first page and a half is that conversation of him saying, I'm not the person you think I am. I'm a very different person. So again, answering your second part of your first question, which is what did I think of him? I thought he was a garrulous, charismatic, loud, fun-loving bloke. And he isn't any of those things. He is shy. And I know people are going to go, nonsense, he's not. He actually is. He does a thing called masking, which is a very common human trait, to disguise your own anxiety and your own insecurity, I suppose, your own discomfort about being in a situation. You hype yourself up. You project a little more than you need to. And Rassie is the master of doing that. When he sits at news conferences with a big, broad smile on his face, you have to know that he's dying inside. Because as I wrote a line for him, and I said, is this an accurate reflection? You'll see it on the first page. I said, I'm socially awkward. I find social occasions difficult. I dislike doing news conferences, but I'm the more I do them, the better I get at them. Something like that. And he said to me, no, Chom, always Chom. T-J-O-M is the way he would write his name on WhatsApp or to address me in WhatsApps. Hey, Chom. He said, no, Chom, that's not right. And I thought he was going to say, no, I'm quite happy doing news conferences. He says, it's not I dislike doing them. I get nervous. And he emphasized this word, nervous. I get nervous doing them. And pieces of the puzzle started falling into place that I was actually dealing with somebody else. And the more I got to know him and work with him, and we would work intensely together, the more I realized that he's actually quite a shy, retiring bloke, and he would love nothing better than having nobody around him except all of his videos of rugby matches, his spreadsheets, his computer, his laptop with all of his spreadsheets, all the data, all the scientific data from the medics, from the physios, from whatever, putting it together, crunching it together, working out strategic plans, analyzing games. That's what he does. He hyper-focuses on rugby. But that hyper-focus is an interesting thing, Kate, because what he also does is when it came time for the book, he then hyper-focused on the book. It was the book to the exclusion of all else. So we would meet, we'd sit, we'd start at 9 o'clock in the morning, and I'd say, right, let's try and finish at 4 or 5 o'clock. And we would talk the entire time. I recorded all of the conversations so that we weren't stopping for taking notes. The only thing we stopped for was a toilet break. I said to him, can we go and get some lunch? No, Chom, let's keep going, because he was on a roll and he was imagining things. And so I then learned that what Russie was actually like, that I couldn't say to him, well, let's take a break, let's go out for lunch. He wasn't like that. And when the sessions ended, he didn't say, well, let's go for a beer. It was over now, and he needed then his quiet time for himself. And I could respect that as well. I saw another side of him.
You mentioned something quite early in that answer about his spreadsheets and his data and all his research, because he was doing that years before he became our top coach. I mean, he really was ahead of the field in the kind of analytics he was doing.
And what's interesting about that, Kate, is that none of the things he did is something that is startlingly new. It's something that any other person could have done. But why did nobody do it? Why was it Russie who was the first one to use video to analyze as a player? There might have been blokes in the basement, I mean, in darkened rooms who weren't rugby players who were doing this kind of thing, but their information was not coming to the fore. It took a rugby player to do this. Why was Russie doing it and nobody else? And he can't explain that, and I can't explain that. In much the same way as his transformation program, this is one of the things that attracted me to the idea of writing Russie's book, is to explore why was it that this Afrikaans boy from this tiny conservative blue-collar town of Dispatch, not Bloemfontein, he comes from Dispatch, which was another kind of misconception about him that we sought out. But why was he able to understand the importance of transformation and how to do it, where black coaches like Alistair Coetzee and Peter de Villiers before him were unable to do? Why, what was it in him when surely, and he did, he grew up in a town of institutionalized racism where people grew up understanding and believing that black people were inferior to them and having no part of their lives. They lived in these townships in the 1980s in the Eastern Cape, which saw so much political violence. How was he able to break through all of that? There was no, as it turned out, there was no epiphany. There was no golden moment. It was through a period of just living a life and seeing what humiliation does to people, what embarrassment does to people. It was a human reaction to a human condition, nothing political about it. And I trace it back to his alcoholic father, who mentally abused him, never physically abused him, who he clearly loved because it upset him a lot to talk about his father, who was the alcoholic, who died a premature death because of the alcoholism, but who instilled in him an understanding that you have to treat people decently. And also for Russie, this word embarrassment is a huge one. His father being a form of embarrassment in the small town because he was an alcoholic, and Russie wanting desperately to ensure that he himself was never in a position where he'd be embarrassed or where anybody else would feel embarrassed or humiliated. And that drove him and informed him when it came to his transformation process. And so his childhood was just so critical.
And I mean, when he appointed Sia Khaleesi as captain of the Springboks, it wasn't done with a fanfare. It was done very, very quietly and subtly, if you like.
Absolutely right, Kate, and it does come as quite a surprise. And it was great fun talking to Russie about that time, because he had just taken over as the coach. He didn't want to be the head coach, but Alistair Coetzee resigned and scuppered his plans. He wanted to be the director of rugby and be the strategist. He didn't want to be the person who dealt with the players and dealt with the media, but now it was forced upon him. So he sat down and he had to pick his first Springbok team. The first team he had to choose played a game against Wales in Washington. They call it a money earner. He felt it was an inconsequential game. The only purpose for it was to generate money, much needed money, for the South African Rugby Union. So he picked a team that went off to Washington, of all places in the USA, including 11 debutants. But his main team, what he felt was his first Springbok team, was in the first test against England for a 3-test series in 2018. So he picked his team and he said, right, who's my captain? And he looked, who was the captain before? It was Eben Etzebeth. Oh, he's injured. Who else has been a captain? Oh, it's It's Warren Whiteley. Oh, he's also injured. So then he looks, he goes, well, who can captain here? So he says, I need somebody who's going to be close to the referee, needs to be able to talk to the referee. So it's got to be a flanker or it's got to be a prop. And he looks, he goes, oh, Sia. Sia's captain of the Stormers. And I've known him. Rusty's known him since he was 16 years old. He's nurtured him. He's grown him. And he knows exactly what he's like. He knows his leader. He goes, okay, I'll make Sia the captain. And that was it. He never ever thought of it as the black captain. He announced it to the team. He didn't do it individually because he doesn't do one-on-ones. He announced it to the team. And they didn't ref. They were happy because they know Sia. They know his impact, his charisma, his leadership ability. So all the team went, yay, Sia's our captain. It was only when he went to Mark Alexander, the president of SARU, and said, here's the team, that he went, oh, my goodness, you've just picked the first black captain in Springbok history. And Russie genuinely went, what? He did not see it coming. And when I went, I thought, this is unbelievable. Surely not. You can't be that blinded to it. You've surely got to understand this. I then looked in Sia Khaleesi's book to get his version of it. It's exactly the same. So that's the way it happened.
And then also he talks, and you talk on his behalf, about these hunches he has. I wrote down here, like picking Mornay for the third and final test against Lions in that British-Irish Lions series. It was, we're playing Mornay, he just announced, like somewhere out of the blue.
I'm so glad you picked that up. No other journalist has asked us about the hunches. And it's such a wonderful story.
Isn't it? It takes a woman to do that.
Exactly right. It takes an astute person, Kate, as well.
Exactly.
But it's such a wonderful story, the hunches. So for people who are not familiar with this, in 12 years, this is now when the Springboks were playing the British and Irish Lions in 2021. 12 years prior to that, Mornay Steyn had come on in, I think it was his second or third test, or was it even his debut? Well, he was very, very new to the Springbok setup, and he had to kick a penalty in the last second of the test match to win not only the game, but the series for the Springboks, and he did it with aplomb. And it became the seminal moment. Mornay Steyn would always be remembered for this. Now it's 12 years later when most rugby players have hung up their boots. But Mornay Steyn is still on the scene and still playing great rugby. He hadn't been in the Springbok team for 5 years, but Rassie decided to call him up for the British and Irish Lions series. Didn't play him in the first test, didn't have him on the bench, nor for the second test. But in the third and final deciding test match, he decided to do something different, and he put Mornay Steyn on the bench. And I said, and what did Mornay do? He kicked the winning penalty in the dying seconds of the game, as he had done 12 years earlier. And I said to Rassie, why did you do that? And he said, well, I saw him kicking the final, that penalty. And I said, so you had a hunch? He said, no, I saw it. I went, what do you mean you saw it? He said, I can't explain it, but I see things and they happen. And I said, no, there's no way I'm putting this in the book. I don't believe in this kind of ethereal stuff. I don't believe that's the way life works. It's got to be an informed decision based on all sorts of things. You don't just see things. He says, let's call. He said, no, he agreed with me. Now we leave that out. But I was too intrigued. I said, this is too fabulous a story. He says, well, I'll tell you what. I don't want you to write the story, but let's get somebody else to tell the story. Let's get Jacques Nienaber, the current coach. We were doing the interviews that particular day at Rassie's office. So Jacques was walking around. So we called Jacques in and sat him down. And I said, what about picking Mornay Steyn? And Jacques laughed. He said, oh, my goodness. He said, I'm a man of science because he's a physiotherapist. He is a much studied man. He's got business degrees as well as physiotherapy degrees. He says, I don't see things in any kind of witchcrafty way.
Woo-woo way.
Thank you. The woo-woo way. He said, but Rassie does. And then he proceeded to give me three other examples of incidents where Rassie had said, I see this happening. He saw a turnover happening in an All Blacks game. Don't run the ball, kick the ball, because I see a turnover. The players ignore him. There's a turnover. They score. They win the game. He predicts scores of rugby matches. And there's one where Jacques had filmed him predicting the score, which then subsequently came true. I think we detail three or four stories of Rassie seeing things, but we can't explain it. We just can't explain it. So I just leave it at that.
That's wonderful. What was the most, I was going to ask you, because, you know, I'm a rugby fan. I'm not a close follower. I watch the big matches. I watch the World Cup, obviously. But I had always, before I read your book, I had always thought Rassie was, like you say, big kind of loudmouth, the water boy, the video, you know, incredibly controversial character. And then I read your book and he's not like that at all. And in fact, just tell us quickly the story of the video. Maybe there are people listening who aren't familiar with that very controversial video.
So Rassie was, this was after the first test against the British and Irish Lions, and the referee was a man called Nick Berry. And Rassie was most confused about his interpretation of a lot of the laws, and he was angry as well because he felt that Nick Berry had dismissed Sia Khodisi every time Sia came to talk to him, but had given Alan Wynne-Jones, the British and Irish Lions captain, a lot of time. And he felt that this was inherently racist and not understanding of the problems that South Africa, perceptions that he was creating in dismissing Sia as easily as he did. So he asked World Rugby, as they are entitled to do, for their feedback on a number of issues. And what happens after every rugby match, this is not unusual, the coaches of the various teams supply clips, video clips to World Rugby to say, could we have some clarity on the adjudication of this particular matter? Because if we are infringing, then we need to know and we can train, coach the players to ensure they don't behave in certain ways. And they were getting no feedback. And Rassie is saying that I need to pick my team for the second test and I need to know how to interpret these laws. And they were getting no feedback and no feedback. And so Rassie, as he said, if you want a different outcome, you've got to do something different. He regrets it now. He understands that it was a mistake, that he blundered, but he made a video in which he presented all of the faults and issues of concern about Nick Berry and then threatened. He will deny the threat, but I mean, it just is so clearly there. He goes, I don't know where this might end up on SuperSport. This might go into the media. I don't know. I think that there was a veiled reference. Rassie will dispute me on that. But what happened was that he sent the video to five people. And those five people were supposed to see it and make comments. One of them was Joel Jute, the head of referees at World Rugby, who said, thank you very much. We take that on board. We appreciate what you've done. Good job. And he thought, well, I've done what I needed to do. I got the response. And they were then able to understand the interpretation of the laws. But in the subsequent hours, so this video exploded. And it had gone around the world and it was now on media. And they couldn't understand why. When they dug down, and it was part of the forensic exercise that was done by World Rugby for Rassie's disciplinary hearing, they found that where there was a breach of the five people who received the initial video, one person spread it further than the five, and that was Nick Berry, the referee himself. And that's not to say that Nick Berry deliberately did it, that he gave it to the media, not at all. But it was this confidence, the circle of trust of five people that had been breached. He sent it on to his agent sent it on to other people, and they all sent it on. So when people say Rassie leaked it to the media, unequivocally you can see through the forensic evidence of that was done by the disciplinary hearing that he didn't. But he was found guilty of having published a video which brought World Rugby into disrepute. If he had sent it to only one person, he would have been equally guilty as if he had sent it to 5 million people. It was that strict interpretation that World Rugby took on this particular matter. But Rassie, while he now says that was a blunder, that was a mistake, he also says, I needed to get a different response, and so I did something different. And I think that amongst the many kind of business lessons people can learn from this, it's that one as well. You can't expect a different outcome by doing the same thing. You've got to do something different. But it was a bit extreme.
And just, we're coming into the last 5 minutes here. What was the most difficult part of working with him or working on the book?
Kate, I can honestly say there was no difficult time. We absolutely loved it. We got on so incredibly well, and we decided right at the beginning that we would trust each other implicitly, and there was no period of making sure that that was the case. Russie just went, I trust you, chum, and let's get on with it. I said to him, we will write everything. You'll tell me everything, and then we'll decide later what to take out, and we took nothing out. So I found nothing difficult. It might have been that because Russie, when he's focusing on rugby, he's focusing on rugby, and maybe, and it's such a minor thing, is that he didn't reply to WhatsApps as quickly as I would have liked. But he was always forthcoming. He gave me so much time, and I'd like to think, you know, we've become quite close. Russie doesn't allow people to be too close to him, but he knows I know all about him. And he once said the sweetest thing to me. He said, David, I will stand in front of a Rottweiler for you. And I thought that is the sweetest thing somebody's ever said to me that also includes the word Rottweiler. And when he was asked by another journalist, what was it like holding the book for the first time? And he got very, very serious. And he said, you know, it felt like the same feeling I got when I held up the World Cup. Wow! That is amazing.
Well, I mean, we're talking about Russie, published by Pat McMillan, written with Russie by, who I'm talking to, David O'Sullivan. If there's any man in your life, any woman in your life, any person in your life who loves rugby, you don't have to know a lot about it. It is an absolutely fascinating book. Last question, David. Low ball. World Cup's just about to start. Who's going to win it?
You see, Russie tells me they won't see us coming. He's been adamant since we started working on the book that the Springboks would win the World Cup. There was a time just recently where things seemed to be going off the rails, where I thought probably not. But, you know, the thing about Russie is that he's always got something else up his sleeve. He's always... the same thing as with making the video. You've got to do things differently. And he's not going to show his cards just yet. I think he might have just shown the cards in the game against the All Blacks by bringing on 7 forwards all at once. I wonder if that is now the way forward. But suddenly the rest of the world is waking up and going, oh, my goodness, these guys are a real threat. So if I was the betting man, which I'm not, but if I was, I'd be putting my money firmly behind the Springboks. I think they've got the depth, the talent, and they're peaking at exactly the right time.
Okay, I'll share a glass of bubbly with you when it happens.
I will look forward to that, Kate, enormously.
Well, that's all for this week. Great interview there with David O'Sullivan, and very unequivocally telling us who's going to win the Rugby World Cup. Well, I'm off to the Okavango, I'm off to Zimbabwe, I'm off to Botswana, and a little side visit, must be about my 8th or 9th visit to the Vic Falls. So I'll be telling you all about that the next time I talk to you. Until then, take care, lots of love, lots of life, look after yourselves, and always look after others too.